But I can't. I'm sorry.
What you saw today, were you looking? Were you trying to tap into him? Or her?
No.
Then what choice do you have?
I can leave.
You left L.A. What good did it do? Cassie, there are monsters everywhere. She closed her eyes and leaned her head back against the chair.
Ben watched her for several moments, unsettled by his intense desire to touch her, hold her. He had never been attracted to emotionally fragile women, to the opposite, if anything. If he admitted the truth, any woman who was not wholly focused on her own life and career and disinterested in anything more than a casual affair had very quickly found him to be elusive and emotionally remote, as Jill could testify. So protective impulses and urges to comfort were alien to his nature when it came to women. He preferred to spend the night in a woman's bed so that he could leave long before dawn with a minimum of fuss, and that alone said a great deal about his avoidance of involvement on any level except the physical. Needy women were definitely not his style. Not that Cassie clung in any way, or indeed had even reached out to him. On the contrary, she was completely self-contained, and everything about her, from the avoidance of touch and even eye contact to her body language, said she was literally untouchable. He thought she needed to be held worse than anyone he'd ever known, but he didn't touch her, because she wouldn't have welcomed the touch, and because he shied away from offering it. Finally, her voice drained, Cassie said, "A few years ago, a cop friend of mine gave me a quotation from Nietzsche. He told me to put it where I could see it every day, to never forget. Whoever fights monsters should see to it that in the process he does not become a monster. And when you look long into the abyss also looks into you." She lifted her head and looked at him with exhausted eyes. "I don't know how many more times I can do it and survive, Ben. Every time I've looked into that abyss, a piece of me stayed there."
"You could never become a monster."
"I could lose myself in one. What would be the difference?" He leaned toward her, elbows on his knees, getting closer without actually touching her.
"Cassie, you're the only one who can decide if the risks are worth taking. The risk of this madman finding out who you are before we find him. The risk of getting too deep in his head. The risk of losing something of yourself in the blackness of his soul. Only you can really know what it might cost you. And only you can decide if the price is too high."
She gazed at him almost curiously. "You pointed out one of the risks yourself. That no matter how careful I am, how skilled, the killer is more than likely to find out who I am in this small town of yours. Even so, you believe I should try to help you catch him." Ben was silent for a moment, then said,
"If you're leaving Ryan's Bluff, the discussion is over. I understand self-preservation. Anyone would. I'll respect that decision, Cassie. But if you're staying here, then you have to help us catch him. Because as long as you're here, you're a potential threat to him. You can see inside his head. Sooner or later, he'll find out you can do that. And he'll come after you."
"So I've convinced you, huh? That psychic ability is real?"
"Let's just say, I'm convinced you're real. I don't pretend to understand it, but I do believe you possess an extraordinary skill. And right now, I need that skill to help me catch a monster before he kills anybody else in my town."
Cassie sighed. "All right. More than anything else, She sounded defeated. What do you want me to do? Ben hesitated, almost wishing he hadn't been so persuasive.
After a lot of arguing, I finally got Matt to agree that you should go to the crime scene. See if you pick up anything.
He paused, then added roughly,
But right now I think you should sleep about 12 hours. Tomorrow's soon enough.
A little laugh escaped Cassie. Very nice of you to be concerned, but not very practical or wise. I'd say there's no time to waste. For him to kill again so soon is a very bad sign of worse things to come.
Be that as it may, you're exhausted. If you push yourself too hard...
You don't have to worry. I won't collapse on you. I'm stronger than you think. She got to her feet. Ben rose as well.
Cassie, a few more hours won't make any difference. She lived alone, and Matt has a couple of his officers standing guard, so the scene won't be disturbed. And it's not going to be a pleasant thing to see, whether you pick up anything or not. You should rest. Recover some of your strength first. I'll take you there tomorrow.
He broke off when she lifted a hand to brush back her hair, and he saw the bandage.
What the hell happened?
She looked at her hand as if it belonged to a stranger, and answered absently, I broke a glass.
Have you seen a doctor?
It wasn't a deep cut. She was obviously puzzled as her gaze returned to his face. Her house. That's where you found her?
Yes. In the kitchen. Isn't that what you saw?
Tension gathering in her voice, Cassie said, The kitchen. No, that isn't right.
He definitely killed her there, Cassie. There was blood everywhere, and the ME says that's where she died.
Cassie closed her eyes for a brief moment, then opened them and looked at him almost beseechingly. Who died, Ben? Who was she?
Why, Ivy Jameson. Isn't that who...
Ben watched her sit down abruptly as though the strength had left her legs. He drew a deep breath.
You mean there's someone else?
Yes. There's someone else. Ben called Matt from the Jeep once they were on their way to town, and the sheriff got there before them. He came out onto the sidewalk so quickly that Ben had barely gotten his door open. It was dark by then, but the streetlights made the sidewalk nearly as bright as day.
Don't go in there, Matt said.
He hadn't really doubted Cassie this time, but Ben nonetheless felt a shock, and with it pangs of pain and regret.
Is she? Matt nodded.
The doc will have to tell us when, but I'm guessing she was killed while we were at Ivy's place. I'm sorry, Ben.
Ben gazed blindly toward the open front door of Jill Kirkwood's store for a moment.
I should have told her to be careful.
It wouldn't have mattered. You know that. I warned her when she came to tell me about somebody following Becky, and I'm sure she thought she was being careful. But even if the town had been under curfew, she wouldn't have hesitated to come into her store on a peaceful Sunday afternoon to catch up on paperwork.
I have to see her.
The sheriff caught his arm.
No. There's no reason for you to go in there, Ben. My team will be here any minute, and this time they're damned well going to get a completely undisturbed crime scene.
He paused, then added steadily,
You don't need to see her. You don't want to see her.
How did he kill her?
Knife. Same as the others. But either he killed her someplace else or she hadn't pissed him off as badly as Ivy had. Virtually no blood at the scene. Only one wound, as far as I could tell. Left breast.
Ben half turned toward the Jeep, where the dome light showed Cassie's huddled posture and pale face. She hadn't said much at all since they had left her place. He returned his gaze to the sheriff.
Cassie said Jill was tied, with her back to something with a sharp edge.
Yeah. She's sitting up against the corner of her desk. He probably had her wrists tied behind her at some point, but, like the others, he left her untied and with her hands in her lap.
The coin?
A quarter.
The sheriff paused.
Mind if I ask a few questions now? Ben knew whom those questions would be directed to, and it wasn't himself. But before he could reply, Cassie got out of the jeep and came around it to join them. Quietly, she said, "Ask away, Sheriff."
"Where were you today?"
"At home. Alone. Until Ben arrived a little while ago."
"You're saying you have no alibi."
The sheriff's voice was mechanical.
"For Christ's sake, Matt," Ben snapped. "Surely you don't believe Cassie killed three women."
The sheriff looked at him briefly, then returned his gaze to Cassie.
"And where is your car, Miss Neal?"
Matter-of-factly, she said, "So you're having me watched. I thought you might be. My car's here in town, Sheriff, as you obviously know. I had it towed in yesterday morning when I discovered it wouldn't start. It's at that garage, one block back from Main Street."
"And you refused a loaner?"
"I didn't need one. There was nowhere I wanted or needed to go in the few days the car would be here."
As alibis went, it wasn't bad.
Ben said,
"She couldn't have walked that far, Matt. Not if Jill was killed in the last few hours."
"Yeah, I know. Besides..." Matt glanced at Ben as he broke off, and it was Cassie who finished the sentence. "It's not likely I'd have the physical strength to drive a butcher knife in someone's chest to the hilt," she said, still matter of fact.
"No," the sheriff said. "It isn't. Possible. But when I add that fact to others, it's very unlikely that you're our killer."
Ben felt sickened.
"The knife. How do you know?"
"It's still in her, Ben. It looks like the missing knife from Ivy's kitchen."
"Christ."
The sheriff kept his gaze on Cassie.
"So you saw Jill being killed, but Ivy Jameson's murder was a complete surprise to you."
"I never knew Miss Jameson, though I had heard of her. I met Jill once, briefly. It was enough for a connection, obviously, because I tapped into her mind, not his."
"Why not his? He killed twice today, leaving a bloody mess behind at Ivy's. Why weren't you aware he was doing that?"
Cassie shook her head. "I don't know." Whatever the sheriff might have said to that was postponed as a squad car and a black paneled van arrived, blue lights flashing. "Take her home, Ben, while I get my people working on the crime scene. Tomorrow is soon enough to find out if she can tell us anything helpful." She went back around the jeep and got in without another word. Ben wanted to censure his friend for his chilly attitude toward Cassie, but knew it wouldn't help matters. So all he said was,
"I'll be back when I've taken Cassie home."
"Don't rush. I said you didn't need to see this one, Ben, and I meant it."
"It's my job to view crime scenes, Matt."
"Not when you were personally involved with the victim. Bad idea."
"We were not personally involved. Not anymore. It was months ago.
Still,
I can handle it," Ben said flatly.
"Will you, for once in our lives, take my advice and my professional opinion and stay the hell away from this crime scene?"
"And when I prosecute the bastard in court, you don't think I'll need details from this crime scene?"
"I think you can get what you need from photographs and reports. Ben, I am asking you, as sheriff and as your friend, to let us handle this." Without waiting for an answer, Matt turned away and went to meet his team. Ben watched them go into the store, then got into the jeep and started the engine.
He's right,
Cassie said. I can handle it, Ben repeated.
Probably. But why should you have to? Why put yourself through that if there's a choice?
Maybe there isn't a choice. It's my job, Cassie.
She didn't respond until the lights of town faded into the night behind them. Ask yourself if Jill would have wanted you to see her like that. And if you have any doubts, the answer is no. She was right, and Ben knew it.
All right.
He was silent for a few more miles, then said,
I'm sorry about the way Matt treats you. He's just pig-headed, and all this is a lot more than he bargained for.
I know.
Don't let him get to you.
He isn't. I've run into the same kind of attitude before, believe me. It's perfectly natural for him to mistrust me.
He just can't believe we have a monster here.
It isn't an easy thing to believe. Ben realized his shock was wearing off just enough to let horror creep in.
My God. 3 women murdered in less than a week. We have no idea who killed them, or why. And we have no idea how many more he'll kill before we catch him. You were right. A serial killer.
I'm afraid so.
Becky, Ivy, Jill. Aside from being female and white, they had virtually nothing in common.
Did they go to the same church? Ben thought about it.
No. Becky and Jill did. The same Baptist church I belong to. But Ivy was a Methodist. Why?
I don't know. Something about the way he had those coins laid out, as though they were on an altar or something, made me think of church.
Cassie shook her head.
At this point, I'm just guessing.
Keep going. You might hit on something.
Something helpful, you mean? Probably not, without more information. The mind of a serial killer is so unique, so subjective, it's almost impossible to generalize beyond a few basic suppositions. And we already know those. White male, since he's killing white females. Young, possibly abused background. But apart from those facts, this man's motivations are bound to be completely unique to him and his experiences. Guessing about them is not going to be productive. Not until we know a lot more than we do now.
There must be a pattern.
There is. To him. But whether we'll even recognize his reasoning is doubtful. There's no logic in madness.
So to catch a madman, we have to think like a madman.
I wouldn't advise it, Cassie said very quietly. That abyss is darker and colder than you can even imagine. Chapter 6. They reached Cassie's house a few minutes later without further discussing the situation, with no reason to hurry back to town, and all too aware of how sleepless the night ahead was likely to be for him. Ben had no intention of just dropping her off and leaving. But he was acutely aware of Cassie's weariness, of spirit as well as body, and doubted she would welcome even casual company. He was wrong.
I could use some coffee. How about you?
She asked, unlocking the door. I'd love some. Thanks.
Cassie disarmed the security system with the tentative touch of someone to whom the steps were still unfamiliar, then led the way to her bright and cheerful kitchen. Ben was too restless to sit while she made the coffee, but wasn't aware he was prowling the room until she spoke again. It wasn't your fault. He checked the back door, making sure it was locked and the new deadbolt thrown.
What wasn't?
Jill's death. He turned to find her leaning back against the sink, arms crossed, watching him gravely. He started to deny that it was bothering him, but couldn't.
I should have warned her.
It wouldn't have mattered. Like the sheriff said, It would never have occurred to her that she should be especially careful going to her store on a Sunday afternoon. Nobody can be on guard all the time.
You can, apparently.
Why did her reserve, her aloofness, bother him so much? That's different.
Is it?
Her shoulders lifted in a little shrug, and her gaze fell away from his. Yes. But we aren't talking about me. There was nothing you could have done to save Jill, except that.
And move on?
We don't have a choice. Death takes people away from us all our lives. We have to move on, or die ourselves.
I know. I know.
It was Ben's turn to shrug.
But it doesn't help, knowing that. She was 32 years old, Cassie. Just 32 years old. She lived here all her life, and she thought she was safe. She should have been safe.
It isn't your fault that she wasn't.
Then whose fault was it?
His. That monster out there. And if he isn't stopped, he'll be responsible for even more deaths.
He'll also be responsible for destroying this town. It's already started. Matt's had to put on more people just to answer the phone since word of Ivy's murder got out. When the morning paper announces Jill's death, things are going to get very tense very fast around here. 3 murders in 4 days. 3 women brutally killed. 1 in her own kitchen.
Cassie turned away to pour the coffee and said very quietly, "The townspeople are going to be looking for someone to blame for those deaths."
"I know."
"Are there any likely targets?" She set his cup on the counter near him, then retreated a few steps with her own.
"You mean the easy targets? The homeless, the disturbed or mentally disabled, those with criminal records?"
"Yes."
"Not many."
Ben picked up his cup and sipped the hot coffee, leaning a hip against the counter, as she did.
"We don't have homeless in any real sense. The churches in the area are pretty good at helping people in need. As for the disturbed or disabled, there are a few of those middle-aged men you see in most small towns. Not slow enough to be unemployable, but not bright enough to be trained for anything but pushing a broom. And there's one woman who's been a well-known character in this town for at least 10 years. She escapes her son's watchful eye from time to time and wanders around downtown picking up invisible things from the sidewalk."
Ben paused and shook his head.
"Nobody knows what she thinks she's picking up, but if you try to stop her, she cries as if her heart's breaking."
Cassie looked down at her coffee. The wreck of a life.
"Her son says she just went away one day."
"I wonder why," Cassie murmured. "Something like that, there ought to at least be a trigger."
"If something definitive happened, I don't know what it was. The family keeps pretty much to themselves, and they don't welcome questions. It's a common enough trait around here."
Cassie nodded distractedly. Then she seemed to rouse herself from pity and focus on the practical. "I would say she seems an unlikely target, but those men, the sheriff might want to keep an eye on them."
"He will. We've both seen a crowd turn ugly and start looking around for a target. That isn't something you forget, believe me."
"What about people with criminal records?"
"We have our share. The habituals commit mostly petty stuff, though. Housebreaking, fighting with their neighbors or their girlfriend's ex-lovers, drunk and disorderly. The sort of troublemakers who have their own bunks in Matt's jail and make regular visits on Saturday nights. As for anything else, crimes of real violence are rare around here. I've prosecuted a couple of manslaughter cases, but liquor and spite were involved both times. Convenience store holdups, a few half-assed bank robberies over the years. But no crime to even hint there's someone living here in this town, or this county, who's capable of butchering 3 women."
Ben sighed.
"That high-tech forensics van Matt managed to wring out of his budget last year was mostly gathering dust. Until Thursday."
"So there's no one target a panicked town would immediately look to?"
"Not that I know of."
except me. He waited until she looked him in the eye, then agreed.
Except you. But I'd say the possibility of anything happening to you because of that is very slight. Cassie, I don't doubt that when word finally gets out about you, there'll be suspicion. But in all honesty, even a panicked town would have to be totally out of its collective mind to suspect you of 3 especially vicious murders. It doesn't always take muscle to kill. But Jill studied karate as a kid, and Ivy quite obviously fought like a wildcat. You couldn't have killed them, and it's obvious.
A reasonable argument. But the need to blame that grows out of panic is seldom based on logic, and you know it.
I know it. Even so, I doubt anyone will seriously suspect you. Oh, they'll look at you, and talk about you, and wonder, and you'll probably get at least a few nasty phone calls accusing you of being a witch or worse. But I don't believe this town will condemn you as a killer.
Cassie returned her gaze to her coffee.
He's the one you have to worry about. That madman out there, the threat to you is from him.
I know.
I talked to Matt about it this afternoon, and he's agreed to say nothing to anyone about you helping us. Neither will I, of course. The longer we can keep it quiet, the less chance there is of the bastard finding out about you.
She smiled faintly. So you think we've got, what, 48 hours or so before the whole town knows?
Rueful, he said. About that, probably. Secrets do tend to get out in small towns.
Well, I'll cross that bridge when I get to it.
Just be careful. Will you, please?
I will. She raised her cup in a small salute. Thanks for sending out the security people, by the way. The place is like a fortress now.
I wish I could believe it would keep you safe.
Cassie met his gaze fleetingly and set her cup on the counter with a sound of finality. I'll be fine. Ben might have obediently taken his leave, but she reached up to brush back a strand of hair, and once again the gesture drew attention to her bandaged hand.
You're bleeding, he said.
Cassie looked at her hand, where a thin line of red stained the white gauze. Damn. He put his cup on the counter and stepped toward her, reaching out without thought.
Let me look.
She took a step back. No. No, thank you. I can take care of it myself.
Ben forced himself to stand still. Cassie, you're so tired, I seriously doubt you could read anybody right now. But whether you can or not, somebody needs to look at that cut. Me or a doctor. Take your pick. I can have one out here in half an hour. Of course, he'd probably insist on a tetanus shot. They usually do. Better to be safe than sorry, they say. Me, on the other hand, I'd more than likely just put on fresh antiseptic and rebandage it. But it's your choice.
Cassie stared at him. Did anybody ever mention that you can be officious as hell sometimes?
Matt likes to mention it.
Ben smiled. She smiled back, if a bit tentatively. Then she drew a breath and visibly braced herself. All right. Determined not to make a big deal out of it in his own mind as well as hers, Ben asked briskly,
Where's your first aid kit?
In that cabinet by the back door.
I'll get it. Sit down at the table and start taking the bandage off, okay?
By the time he joined her with the kit, she had the gauze unwound, revealing a long, thin slash across her palm that was bleeding sluggishly. Cassie said, Funny I didn't notice before. The cut exactly follows my fate line. If I were superstitious, I'd probably worry about that.
Do you tell fortunes, too?
Ben asked lightly, removing what he needed from the first aid box. I've never been able to predict the future. I told you that when we met. But my mother could, and I was told Aunt Alex could.
Really? I heard a couple of odd stories about her seeming to know things she shouldn't have known, but just chalked it up to rumors. She was so seldom in town that few people knew her except to say hello.
Cassie shrugged. I don't know the extent of her abilities, My mother refused to talk about her, and her own instances of precognition were few and far between.
So her principal ability was like yours, the ability to tap into another mind.
Yes. Judging that the time was right, Ben said,
"Let's see that hand."
And immediately added,
"So, do you have a secondary ability?"
Cassie's hesitation was almost imperceptible. She placed her hand palm up in his and said steadily, "If I do, I haven't discovered it yet. But then, I haven't looked." Ben held her cool hand in his and kept his gaze on it as he wiped fresh blood from the wound. But virtually all his attention was focused on her voice, his awareness filled with this first physical touch.
"Why haven't you looked? Afraid of what you might find?"
"Let's just say that the primary ability is enough to deal with. I don't want another." Ben nodded, then said,
"I don't think this is deep enough to need stitches. You were right about that. I'll put on some antiseptic and a fresh bandage. You said you cut it on a broken glass?"
"Yes, a clean glass, so no fear of tetanus." Ben opened a tube of antiseptic and began to apply the cream to her hand. Unwilling to allow a silence to grow between them, he said,
"Earlier, you referred to your ability as the sight. That's an ancient name for it, isn't it?"
"I suppose. It was always called that in my family."
He glanced up from her hand. "Always?"
She was looking at him with an unusually steady gaze, her eyes impenetrable and her expression calm. He had no idea whether she was able to read him, and he didn't feel her gaze as he sometimes did. Was it because she was actually touching him? Cassie nodded slowly. "It's like one of those stories you see in fiction. I'm not the seventh daughter of a seventh daughter, but the sight has been in my family for generations, almost always handed down from mother to daughter."
"What about the sons?"
"There haven't been any in the last few generations of my mother's line. Further back, I'm not sure. According to the family stories, it was a female gift exclusively."
Ben smiled. "Maybe to level the playing field?"
"The boys got the muscle and the girls got the sight?" Cassie smiled as well. "Maybe." He returned his attention to her hand, putting a clean gauze pad in place over the wound, and then winding gauze around her hand to secure it.
"So if you have a daughter, she's likely to be psychic."
"I suppose," Cassie said. With more reluctance than he wanted to show or admit to himself, Ben released her hand.
"All done. That wasn't so bad, was it?"
"Thank you."
"You're welcome."
He kept his voice light.
"So, could you read me?"
Cassie didn't answer for a moment, gazing down at her hand as she flexed the fingers slowly. Then she looked up, a very faint frown between her brows. "No. No, I couldn't."
"Not at all?"
She shook her head. "Not at all. A very closed book." Ben was a little surprised at first, but then wondered if he should have been.
"Like I said, you're probably too tired to read anybody tonight."
For an instant, her eyes seemed to bore into his, and he felt that touch again, still cool, but so firm this time that he almost glanced down to see if she had reached across the table and laid her hand on his chest. Then Cassie was smiling just a little, and her voice was casual. "You're right. I am tired."
"I'll go and let you get some rest."
Cassie didn't protest. She walked him to the front door. "It would probably be a good idea for me to see Mrs. Jameson's house tomorrow. I don't know if I'll be able to pick up anything, but I should try."
"I'll come get you, since you're without a car. Early afternoon, all right?"
"Yes, fine."
"Good. Sleep late, okay? Get some rest."
"I will. Good night, Ben."
"See you tomorrow."
Cassie watched him until he reached his Jeep, then closed the door and locked it, and set the security system. She went back to the kitchen, put away the first aid kit, and rinsed out the used coffee cups. The action's automatic. She hadn't eaten anything since breakfast, but wasn't hungry now, and definitely didn't want to bother fixing anything. Her hand ached, but that was her own fault. It hadn't been hurting until she'd dug her nails into the gauze to reopen the wound, just before calling Ben's attention to it. For all the good it did. She hadn't really suspected Ben of being the killer, but she'd seen too many outwardly decent men with black souls to discount anyone, at least until she was able to see inside their minds. Unfortunately, she hadn't been able to read him, and she was afraid it wasn't because she was tired. He had walls, solid and strong ones, the kind of walls that few non-psychics ever needed to build, unless they had experienced some sort of emotional or psychic trauma. Had Ben? Was there, in that seemingly open and honest man, some secret hurt or experience that had left him guarded and wary at the deepest levels of himself? Nothing in his background suggested that, but Cassie knew only too well how inadequate was the public information about a life lived. It was the most likely explanation, that Ben's walls came from some injury or bitterly learned knowledge in his past. The only non-psychic guarded minds she had encountered had owed their walls to trauma rather than to design. He was not psychic. He was also not the killer. Cassie owed that certainty partly to her psychic ability. It had come to her as she had watched him gently examine her hand, the sudden memory of the killer who had stood over Jill Kirkwood, gloved hand raised to plunge the knife into her body. His sleeve had fallen back, revealing his wrist, and on the inside had been a distinct scar. Ben had no such scar. It was a relief, but Cassie wasn't much cheered by it. She dreaded the coming days. Though Ben had shown some awareness of and sensitivity to the fact that this was and would be an ordeal for her, he couldn't really understand what it would cost her. But he had been right in telling her that if she remained in Ryan's Bluff, she had to help them. Not only because it was her responsibility to help, as her mother had drummed into her from childhood, but also because she was in line to become a target for this killer, and stopping him was the only way to save her own life. She was tempted to run. More than tempted. But Ben had also been right in pointing out that there were monsters everywhere. Besides, she had found the first real piece of her life in this place, and gratitude also drove her to help. If she could. If anyone could. Cassie made herself a cup of hot tea and soaked for a while in a hot bath, not thinking very much about anything. Then she went to bed early, praying she wouldn't dream. That particular prayer went unanswered. Oh, Christ, he hated the dreams. Why wouldn't they leave him alone? And the voices. Why wouldn't they stop talking to him? He just wanted to sleep. He just wanted to rest. Why were they making him do these things? His hands smelled like coins. His clothes. He thought his hair did, too. Like coins. Like blood. Shh. No more voices. Not tonight. No more dreams. He was so tired. February 22nd, 1999. It was Sheriff Dunbar who came to get her the next afternoon, and he looked no happier about it than Cassie felt. Ben got tied up in court, he said by way of a greeting. He'll meet us at Ivy's place. I see. If you're ready, of course. Cassie thought that if he were any more polite, his face would break. I'm ready. Just let me lock up. 5 minutes later, they were in his cruiser and headed toward town, and the silence was vast. Despite her casual words to Ben, Cassie was hyper-aware of the sheriff's suspicion and mistrust. She had formed good relationships with a number of cops over the years, but it was true that the first reaction tended to be the sheriff's, and it was always difficult for her. In the beginning, it had deeply upset her that her first role in an investigation was invariably that of suspect. Hard-headed and rational cops viewed her descriptions of crimes and victims as obvious proof she had been present in the flesh, and they were difficult to persuade otherwise. It was often only when cast-iron proof in the shape of unbreakable alibis surfaced that some policemen learned, if not to trust her, then at least to believe she was no killer. As far as Matt Dunbar was concerned, a fair alibi for at least one of the murders was obviously not good enough. Either that or... You think I'm conning Ben, don't you? That I'm conning both of you? It crossed my mind, he replied bluntly. What would I have to gain? He sent her a quick glance, and his smile was cynical.
How should I know? Maybe you're after fame. Or maybe you just like playing with people.
Cassie felt a spurt of amusement. Let me guess. Somebody dragged you into a lot of fortune-tellers' tents when you were a kid, right?
Close, but no cigar. Let's just say I've known a few people in my life who were royally taken by con artists posing as psychics.
Amusement dying, Cassie said. I'm sorry. No wonder you're suspicious. But I'm not like that, Sheriff. I don't sit in a tent or a room hung with velvet and gaze into a crystal ball. I don't tell anybody how to make their life better, or claim to see a tall, dark stranger in their future. I don't pick lottery numbers or racehorses, or the sequence of cards at blackjack. And I never, ever take money for using this gift of mine. Didn't all those testimonials give you pause?
There's more than one way to con somebody, and more than one reason to do it.
Meaning I conned them? All those rational, suspicious cops? Do you really believe that?
Dryly, he said, I think there's at least as much a chance of that as there is that you're genuine.
So I'm definitely on probation as far as you're concerned.
Definitely.
Cassie nodded. Some people are never able to accept psychic ability, and some are afraid of it once they realize it's real. She turned her head and looked at him thoughtfully. But it would make things easier on both of us, I think, if you could begin to believe that it's not a con.
And how do you propose to accomplish that? Gonna tell me what color panties Abby had on last night?
Green, Cassie said. When he glared at her, she grimaced. Sorry, I know you were being sarcastic, but it was practically branded on your forehead in neon, Sheriff. If you want to test me, you'll have to do better than that.
Test you, he said slowly.
Why not? You won't be the first to do it, and I expect you won't be the last. You can go the old think of something I couldn't possibly know route, or you can get more inventive. Spring a test on me when I'm not expecting it. I don't really care. Just bear in mind that there are psychic abilities I definitely don't have. I can't foretell the future, and I can't move anything with my mind.
You can just crawl into somebody else's mind.
Some minds, not all. She hesitated, then said, I can't read Ben.
Not even when you touch him?
Not even then. The sheriff was silent for a moment, then muttered,
That rings truer than anything you've said yet.
She looked at him curiously. Really? Why? It was his turn to hesitate, but then he shrugged without answering. Cassie didn't push him, because his thoughts were so clear he might as well have spoken aloud. He was thinking that Ben had never let anybody really get close, from the time they were kids. That his old man was one of those emotional tyrants you read so much about, especially in stories set in the South. A highly respected judge himself, with an iron will and the absolute conviction that his word was law. Matt suspected that one of the reasons Ben had stepped down from the bench himself was that his father had died, and so was no longer able to influence his only son. Cassie rubbed her forehead and tried to shut off the easy connection with the sheriff. But before she could, she was also gifted with the information that Ben had been a late child, born of the old judge's second and much younger wife, Mary, whom Matt thought of as one of those pretty, childlike women who would either fascinate a man or else drive him mad. "Headache?" the sheriff asked.
"You could say that,"
Cassie murmured, resisting the impulse to tell him to stop thinking so damn loud, and wondering if Ben had any idea that here was one friend whose shrewd understanding nevertheless left him wondering what it was that Ben Ryan wanted out of life for himself. A closed book indeed. The sheriff was silent for several minutes, then muttered beneath his breath, "Green panties." "They were, weren't they? And a bra to match?"
"Yes, damn it."
Chapter 7. The blood in Ivy Jameson's kitchen had dried, and the smell of it was musty and faint. But it remained a scene of violence, and Cassie was overwhelmingly conscious of that the moment she stepped through the doorway.
"We have the murder weapon," Sheriff Dunbar said, from his position inside the room to the right of the door. "If it would help to touch it?"
"No." Cassie slowly looked around. "Not if it has her blood on it." She wasn't aware of anything unusual at first, but then she felt a slight but increasing pressure against her chest or inside it, and breathing seemed more difficult than it had a moment before.
"Cassie?"
Ben was standing just behind her in the doorway.
"Are you all right?"
"I don't know. Yes. Yes, I'm fine." She continued to gaze around slowly, unwilling to tell him it was getting harder and harder for her to breathe. Her gaze focused on a pool of dried blood near the work island that was dark and slick-looking, and when she blinked, it suddenly turned scarlet. The image was fleeting, a jolt of color gone before she could fully take it in, but when she looked at the blood spattered across the white refrigerator, it too turned briefly scarlet. And then a movement caught her eye, and she turned her head to watch scarlet blood drip from the edge of the work island and onto the tile floor. "Jesus," she whispered.
"Cassie, what is it?"
"Shh. Don't say anything. This has never happened to me before. When I look at it, I see the blood dripping, as if it's fresh. Splashes and smears of color all over the room, bright and wet." She closed her eyes and opened them, but the blood remained red. So red, it hurt to look at it. And when she tried to turn her head away, it was as if she caught a flash of movement from the corner of her eye. Every time she turned her head back and forth, that flash of movement was there, just out of her range of vision, teasing her by vanishing when she tried to focus on it. Then a scream ripped through her head so loudly and violently, it was like a blow, and for a single eternal instant, she saw Ivy Jameson sitting on the bloody floor of her kitchen, her back up against the leg of the work island, her once white dress horribly stained, and her open eyes staring across the room at Cassie with reproach. Cassie wanted to run from that awful condemnation, to escape the dreadful knowledge in Ivy's gaze, but suddenly, the pressure on her chest became crushing. There was no air. No air at all. And the scarlet and white kitchen was engulfed by a wave of total darkness. The silence was absolute. And it was so peaceful, Cassie was tempted to remain there. There were horrors waiting for her outside the tranquil darkness, waking nightmares she was not ready to face. But then someone began calling her name, the sound intruding on peace, and she knew she had to respond.
"Cassie?"
She opened her eyes and was instantly alert, not at all drained or exhausted by what had happened. She found herself lying on a sofa in a very formal living room. Ben was sitting on the edge near her hips and held one of her hands in his. Cassie tensed automatically to draw her hand away, but then she realized she was still unable to read him. His hand felt very warm.
"Told you she'd be all right," the sheriff said laconically from a nearby chair.
"Are you?" Ben asked, gaze intent on her face. Cassie nodded slowly. "Yes. Yes, I'm fine." He helped her to sit up, but didn't release her hand or move away until it became obvious she was indeed all right. He stayed beside her on the couch, half turned so he could watch her more closely.
"You want to tell us what happened?"
"I don't know what happened. Just that it's never happened before."
"What never happened before?" the sheriff demanded. "All you said was that you saw the blood turn wet and red, and then you fainted gracefully into Ben's arms."
Cassie ignored his mockery and looked at him rather than at Ben when she said, "I saw the bloodstains turn wet and red. Some even dripped from the island onto the floor. And then, for just a moment, I saw Ivy Jameson sitting on the floor, her back against the leg of the island, her dress red with blood. She was looking across the room at me almost accusingly."
"So whose head were you in?"
"I don't know. It was as if I were standing in that room just moments after the killer left."
"How do you explain it?" Ben asked.
"I can't explain it. Unless..."
"Unless?" the sheriff prompted.
Cassie gazed into the distance, thinking, then said, "Unless someone else did that. Stood in the doorway only minutes after the murder. Someone I've connected to without realizing. Maybe I was reliving someone's memory."
The sheriff shook his head. "You seem to have connected to an awful lot of people, if you ask me."
Ignoring him, Ben asked,
"Was it Matt? You were able to read him earlier. Could you have picked up these images from his experience when he first arrived here in the house and saw her?"
"I don't know." She looked at the sheriff. "Except for her body being gone, is the room just the way you found it?"
"Almost."
He didn't elaborate. Cassie got up. "I need to see it again."
"Are you sure?" Ben asked. "The first time hit you pretty hard."
"I'm sure." She led the way back to the kitchen, stopping just inside the doorway as she had before. This time, both men remained behind her. Cassie concentrated on remembering what she had seen, comparing the details with the room as she saw it now. Her body was there, at the corner of the island nearest the stove. A foot or so away, there was a knife, a butcher knife, covered in blood. Her gaze roamed slowly around the room. There were footprints in the blood near the back door, but the footprints on this side of the room weren't there. That's the only other difference I see.
"Then you weren't seeing Matt's first look into the room," Ben said.
She turned to the two men. "No?" Ben was staring at the sheriff.
"No. The footprints on this side of the room were made by Ivy's relatives when they found her, before they called Matt."
"So I saw the room before they entered it?"
"I'd say so, yes."
"Then someone else must have been here." The sheriff scowled at her.
"Why couldn't it have been the killer standing there? Assuming any of this bullshit is true, that is."
"I don't think it was him. I didn't get a sense of him the way I have before. As a matter of fact, I didn't get a sense of anyone. No personality, I mean."
"Then what makes you so sure somebody else was here?"
Cassie thought about it, but finally had to shake her head in defeat. I don't know. Just by process of elimination. I've never been able to tap into a place. Not like that. To see so vividly something that had already happened, I had to be seeing through somebody's eyes, through their memories. Somebody standing right here, just inside the doorway. After Mrs. Jameson was killed, but before her relatives got here. Slowly, Ben said,
"In plenty of near-death experiences, people report being out of their bodies, hovering nearby and looking at themselves. Is it at all possible that you saw this room through Ivy's eyes after her murder?" "That," the sheriff said, "is the creepiest thing I've heard yet."
Ben was gazing at Cassie.
"But is it possible?"
"I don't know." She agreed with the sheriff. It was a creepy possibility. If so, it would be a first for me. Sheriff Dunbar shook his head.
"Either way, I don't see that this is getting us anywhere. There's no evidence there was anybody other than the killer and Ivy in this house until her relatives arrived. In the meantime, I have three bodies and a town full of people beginning to panic. Unless you can tell me something helpful, I think I'll go back to my good old-fashioned police methods and try to find this bastard before he kills anybody else."
Cassie nodded. "Two things. Before he killed Jill Kirkwood, he said something to her. He said, 'You'll never laugh at me again.'"
"Laughing at people wasn't Jill's style," Ben said immediately.
"In his mind, she had laughed at him, belittled him. Maybe they all had, at least as far as he was concerned," Cassie said. "For what it's worth."
"And the other thing?" the sheriff asked.
"That may be more helpful. He held the knife in his right hand, and on the inside of that wrist was a scar. I think he's tried to kill himself, at least once."
"Just when did you remember seeing that?"
"Last night." Cassie shrugged. "I would have called you, but I knew I'd see you today."
And she knew he was disinclined to believe her anyway. It was obvious. Still, the sheriff was grudgingly pleased by something concrete. "Okay. I'll add those details to what little we've got so far." "Are you going to call the FBI?" Ben asked.
"Not yet.
Matt, don't tell me my job, Ben." "Look, at least get in touch with that violent crimes task force operating out of Charlotte. They have more resources, Matt. They can help."
"Their resources don't mean jack shit."
The sheriff's jaw was set stubbornly.
"You know and I know that this killer is not going to be found in anybody's computer database, Ben. He's homegrown."
Cassie divided her attention between them. "Then you're sure he's not a stranger? A newcomer in town?"
"Positive."
"Matt, there's no way we can be positive."
"I'm positive. Ivy's relatives swear she would never have opened a door to a stranger, much less invite one into her kitchen."
"She could have let him in the front door."
"And then put the chain back on the way her nephew and brother-in-law found it later?"
"No.
She knew him, Ben. She let the bastard into the house through her back door, and she felt so unthreatened by him that he was able to cross the room and pick up one of her own butcher knives."
Ben frowned but shook his head.
"What about Becky? Cassie thinks she didn't know her killer."
Cassie said, "She didn't say his name at a point when she should have, so she probably didn't know it. But that's just an assumption on my part."
The sheriff said, "That doesn't mean he's a stranger to the area. Small town or not, none of us knows every one of our fellow citizens."
Ben granted the point with a nod, but said,
"Still, we can't be sure, Matt. And even if you're right about it, the task force has other resources we could use. They have experts in forensics and behavioral science, to name just two."
"I can and will handle this investigation," the sheriff said flatly.
I'm not handing it off to the FBI, a task force, or to anyone else. Remember when they came cruising in here a few years ago, Ben? The FBI and DEA, tracking drug runners up from Florida, and convinced the operation was based around here? I've never seen such a mess in my life. The rights of decent citizens trampled without so much as a by your leave. Property destroyed, people up in arms. My father had a heart attack before it was all over and done with. Sheriff Dunbar shook his head. Uh-uh. No way am I going to let anything like that happen again. Not in my town. With barely a pause, he added, Now, if you two don't mind, I say we get out of here. I need to lock up the place and get back to the office. And I'm sure both of you have better things to do with the rest of your afternoon. Cassie didn't protest, and Ben didn't say anything else until they got into his Jeep. Then, watching the sheriff's cruiser drive away, he shook his head. I'm afraid it was a mess, and it left a bad taste in the mouth for most of the people around here. As nervous as this town is getting, Matt won't be criticized for not turning to outsiders for help.
Can he handle this on his own?
Ben started the engine and put the Jeep in gear. I don't know. He's no fool, and he's got plenty of smart people working for him. But this is something outside of his experience. He never worked homicide during his training as a cop, and he sure as hell never dealt with a serial killer.
He made a good argument for Mrs. Jameson's killer not being a stranger to her. Logical and reasonable. You still don't agree?
I just don't agree that it's definitive. There's a chance, however unlikely, that Ivy let a stranger in, or at least opened the door to one. And you say the man who killed Jill wore a mask. She sure as hell wouldn't have opened the door to a masked man. So I have to wonder if her door was even locked. Maybe she was careless and didn't lock it behind her when she went in. Maybe Ivy was careless for once. It happens.
To both of them on the same day?
Ben grimaced. Unlikely, yes. But possible.
After a moment's thought, Cassie said, I have to say he convinced me. And a man who was a stranger to Becky could still be someone Mrs. Jameson knew. If he is local, sooner or later there's bound to be some connection between the killer and at least one of his victims. I guess we'll just have to wait and see if Sheriff Dunbar's investigation turns up anything.
Such as more bodies?
Ben's voice was grim. Maybe you'll find the connection, if there is one. Or evidence that points to a particular man. If he's right about this killer being from the area, then he probably has a much better understanding of the people here and any potential suspect than outside law enforcement officials could ever get.
He understands the people here, but I doubt he has any special insight into the mind of this killer.
Ben sent her a quick glance.
Your help could prove invaluable, Cassie. That hasn't changed.
Without responding to that, she said, If you could just take me as far as the garage, I'd appreciate it. They called this morning to say my car was ready, so I said I'd pick it up.
Ben turned the Jeep in the direction of the garage, but said, Should you be driving? You were out cold for nearly 5 minutes.
Cassie was a little startled. So long. I hadn't realized. But it's all right. I feel fine. Whatever happened back there didn't take nearly as much out of me as the usual connections do.
Could have fooled me. You went white as a sheet before you passed out.
There was a note in his voice that made her feel suddenly self-conscious, but Cassie managed to keep her own voice casual. Shock, I imagine. Seeing her sitting there, the way she seemed to be looking at me was so unexpected. She paused. What if someone else was there? Why wouldn't they have come forward?
Probably afraid of being a suspect. And I really don't like the idea of a witness to a crime scene who's out there possibly telling friends and family what that crime scene looked like. So far, we've been able to keep certain details quiet. If word gets out about the way the victims were found posed, the coins in their hands, the weapons used, it could make it more difficult to prosecute the case if and when it comes to court.
I don't suppose you're worried about a copycat killer, Cassie said absently.
Not really. Assuming Matt's right, I find it just barely credible that this sleepy little town could produce one vicious killer. Two operating at the same time would surprise me very much.
Well, maybe whoever it was who might have witnessed the murder scene will be too frightened to talk about it.
Maybe. But secrets tend not to stay secret for very long in this town.
Cassie thought about that after he dropped her off at the garage. She paid her bill and waited for her car to be driven around front, and it didn't take a psychic to sense the unease of the mechanics. All they could talk about were the murders, and speculation was running rife.
It's got to be a stranger. I mean, who around here would do such a thing?
One mechanic standing a few feet from Cassie demanded of his companion.
I know plenty who could have murdered Ivy, the second man said with a snort.
Then he sobered and added,
but not the other two. Not Miss Kirkwood or Becky.
You think it was the same guy?
Well, it must have been. I heard that the sheriff found them all holding flowers. Is that sick or what?
Flowers? I heard it was candles.
Candles? Now, what kind of sense does that make? Honestly, Tom, you'd believe anything anybody told you.
The discussion faded away as they walked toward the back, and since Cassie's car was delivered to her then, she left the garage and drove toward her next stop, the supermarket. She had decided to run a few errands since she was in town anyway, and in all honesty, she also wanted to get a sense of the mood of the townspeople. The cashier at the supermarket, unlike the mechanics, was not disposed to be fascinated by the subject. When the customer in front of Cassie asked what she thought of the murders, the teenager looked as if she would burst into tears.
Oh, Mrs. Holland, it's so awful. Becky was in school with my sister, and Miss Kirkwood was just the nicest lady. And I heard they had awful things done to them, just awful. I'm so scared. All the girls are so scared.
The customer murmured a few reassuring words, but it was clear she was none too confident in her own optimism. Cassie noticed that she glanced around her warily as she pushed her shopping cart from the store. Cassie had bought a few perishables, but it was a chilly day, and she didn't worry when she parked her car downtown, locked it up, and went for a stroll. She window shopped and listened to the people around her talk, winding up in a booth in the drugstore. The young counterman, whose name, according to the pin on his shirt pocket, was Mike, was obviously excited by the fact that he had actually been questioned by deputies. He eagerly shared the experience with her as he poured the coffee she had ordered.
On account of Becky working here and all, he explained.
And they wanted to know if we'd noticed anybody following or watching her, or if she'd told us somebody had.
And had she? Cassie asked, more because he so clearly wanted to talk about it than because she did.
Not a word to any of us.
Mike polished the counter in front of Cassie industriously.
Not that I talked to her much, since her job was back in the office, but Mrs. Selby says Becky never told her either. And none of us ever noticed her being watched or followed, nothing like that.
He lowered his voice conspiratorially.
And now, there's Mrs. Jameson and Miss Kirkwood, too. It's just horrible, isn't it?
Yes, Cassie said. Horrible. Before he could prolong the conversation, she retreated to a booth with the day's newspaper and her coffee. The newspaper articles were fairly restrained, given the unusual violence of the crimes. The latest murders had made the front page, and the story was the headline. But the tone of the piece was low-key, and just reported the facts as they were known. Two women murdered, presumably within hours of each other, and less than a mile apart. Assailant unknown. The sheriff's department was investigating, and if anyone had anything to report, they could call the department, number provided. Inside the newspaper, on the editorial page,
A far more worried voice wondered if there should be a curfew, more deputies patrolling, and more openness from the sheriff. The intimation was that he was keeping to himself details of the crimes, and that those details, if known, might enable the good citizens of Ryan's Bluff to better protect themselves. Perhaps they should not have elected someone with a bare dozen years of police experience, no matter who his father had been. Ouch, Cassie murmured, wondering if Sheriff Dunbar's methodical police work was going to prove a political liability to him in the near future. She knew from her own research that Dunbar had gained his police experience in Atlanta, rising to detective shortly before he had returned home to Ryan's Bluff, when his father had announced his retirement as sheriff. An unkind soul might have indeed said that Matt Dunbar had won the election on his name alone, but that would have been untrue. He was qualified for his job, that was certain, and he had fairly good political instincts, though word had it he had run afoul of the town council at least once since taking office. In any case, there was probably no one better qualified for the job of sheriff in the county, certainly not better qualified to investigate a series of murders, so the stinging editorial held a note of spite rather than reason. Or a note of panic. A few pages later, there were articles about both Ivy Jameson and Jill Kirkwood, human interest pieces about the lives of the two women. Ivy's history and good works were stiffly presented with an air of pious resolution, while Jill's life story was told with warmth and genuine regret. Two women, one widely despised and the other highly regarded, and one young girl who had, by all accounts, never harmed a soul, all horribly murdered in the same small town within days of one another. Cassie thought the newspaper had done a fine job in getting so much information in print in a Monday edition, when the two latest murders had taken place the day before. But she didn't doubt that upcoming editions would sound much less detached. The days ahead promised to be rough. She laid the paper aside and sipped her coffee thoughtfully, vaguely aware of the people moving about in the drugstore. She didn't dare call it a pharmacy, since no one else did. Shopping or just visiting with each other. This was a central gathering spot for downtown, a fact Cassie had discovered early on. But there were few people in the soda fountain side of the store, so Cassie instantly sensed when someone paused beside her booth. She looked up to see a stunning redhead, too model gorgeous to belong in this small town. In a rather roundabout way, Cassie recognized her. Miss Neal? My name is Abby. Abby Montgomery. I knew your aunt. May I talk to you? Green panties. Cassie pushed the knowledge away, reflecting, not for the first time, that psychic abilities could provide certain facts that were nothing but embarrassing. She gestured toward the other side of the booth. Please, have a seat. And I'm Cassie. Thanks. Abby sat down with her own coffee. She was smiling, but though her gaze was direct, her green eyes were enigmatic. Without even trying, Cassie knew that here was another mind she would find it impossible to tap into, and that certainty made her feel much more sociable than was usual for her. It was nice not to have to worry over much about keeping her own guard up. So you knew Aunt Alex? Yes. We met by chance a few months before she died. At least, I thought it was by chance. It wasn't? Abby hesitated, then let out a little laugh. Looking back, I think she wanted to meet me. She had something she wanted to tell me. Oh? Yes. My destiny. I see. Cassie didn't ask what the prediction had been. Instead, she said, I was told Aunt Alex had the gift of prophecy. You were told? Cassie had little doubt that Matt Dunbar had discussed her abilities with his lover. He was a very open man in virtually every way, and his nature would be to confide in the woman he loved.
So she was certain that Abby knew she was, or claimed to be, psychic. She suspected that this meeting was in the nature of a test, or a confirmation. Cassie said, I was only a little girl when my mother and Aunt Alex quarreled, and I never saw or heard from her again, until I got word of her death and learned I'd inherited her property here. So all I really know about her are the few things I overheard as a child. Then you don't know if she was always right. Abby's voice was as calm as Cassie's had been, but there was something in the tension of her posture and the white-knuckled grip on her coffee cup that betrayed strong emotion. Careful now, Cassie said. No psychic is always 100% right. The things we see are often subjective, sometimes symbolic images that we filter through our own knowledge and experiences. If anything, we're translators, attempting to decipher a language we only partly understand. Abby smiled wryly. So the answer is no. No. I don't know if Aunt Alex was always right, but I doubt very much if she was. She said, she told me there was a difference between a prediction and prophecy. Is that right? Precognition isn't really my bailiwick.